Hello, it's me again, Greg Kelly, podcast form. We will not be having a guest today because we're transitioning to a new format. I'll be talking to a new and different type of guest. We'll talk about that in the next podcast. In the meantime, this is a podcast featuring me and some questions from you, the listeners, that have been compiled, by Maya Zumwalt, the executive producer. And I will be going through them. I have not seen them yet. I am very curious as to what these questions are about. I'm told that they're somewhat personal. They're somewhat, they're all related to me in some way, shape, or form. And in the meantime, I've heard, you know who I heard do this once? It was actually very interesting. Who likes Tim Ferriss? I listened to his podcast about 5 years ago. Very, very good. And every now and then he would do a podcast about him. I found it quite enjoyable. So let's see if we reach something similar here in terms of enjoyment levels. All right. So lately, you may have heard that I am trying to lose weight. I am succeeding. My wife has been pushing for a long time, eat more salad. And now I found a way to actually eat more salad with the right dressing. I'm not kidding. A friend told us about Semper Savage salad dressings and marinades, and I have never tasted such flavor. This is great, great stuff. They have Savage Caesar, Savage Cider, Savage Balsamic, to name a few. They are very delicious. I recommend all of them. Semper Savage is a veteran-owned, family-operated company that makes the most delicious salad dressings and marinades on the planet. What's more, all Semper Savage products are made with all natural ingredients like extra virgin olive oil, vinegars, herbs, and spices. And because they have no added sugar or preservatives, they are completely keto, paleo, and Whole 30 friendly. That's very important for me. I've been doing the keto plan, and I am eating so much salad. I am seeing the results. It really is exciting. If you want more flavor in your life and feel good about supporting a veteran-owned, family-operated company, visit SemperSavage.com. Semper Savage, that's SemperSavage.com. SemperSavage.com. It is a super tasty salad dressing that is homemade, American-made, and from all natural ingredients. And if you enter the promo code GK10, that's my initials, GK10, you will get a whole 10% off when you check out, and they'll know exactly how many people did it, because that's really what's going on here, okay? So, look, I support these guys. I love their product. Veteran-owned, it's very important. You realize how much veterans give up? Some of them spend 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the military, which is like its own culture. It's beautiful, but it's very different from the rest of the world, and sometimes you get out. You know, there's at least a short-term disadvantage. You come out with a lot of tools that you can not get anywhere else. But so I love them because they're veterans, and it's a great product. So check them out, SemperSavage.com, SemperSavage.com. And remember, that promo code, GK10, you'll get 10% off. I'll get the credit, and everybody will be very happy. So thank you very much for that, and we thank Semper Savage. And now it's time for these questions that I have not seen. And here we go. Let me call them up here. Number one, where and when were you born? That's my business. You're trying to find out how old I am? I was born on December 17th, 1968, in Manhasset, New York, on Long Island. North Shore Hospital is where I was born. At the time, I was living in Baldwin, New York. I'm the younger of two children. My brother Jimmy is about 3 years older than I am. Let's see, my dad, I believe at the time, 1968, was studying to take the sergeant's exam. He'd already come home from Vietnam, and he was also enrolled in law school. He was studying when he was waiting in the waiting room. That's what I know. It was either for law school or the sergeant's test. I should actually find that out. Back then, you know, you had the fathers had to wait in the waiting room. Now they're in the operating room. They're taking movies. It's just, it's a little much, in my opinion. Although it's beautiful because when my baby was born last February, I was right there, and it was very, very amazing. February of 2020, I should point out. All right, where did you go to school? Why don't I start from the beginning? I went to St. Mark's Nursery School, St. Mark's and Rockville Center for Nursery School. I remember very well. Before that, it was Bible school, which I refused to attend. I followed my mother home. It was three doors down from our house. I have a vivid memory of being dropped off there and following my mother home. She did not know I was following her. I was about 10 feet behind her. We only lived maybe three or four doors away from the Bible school. So that was my first. And then I remember going to nursery school and not letting my mother leave. I was very attached and very afraid of being left alone. And as long as she was there, I was having a grand time. But then when it was time for her to go, I panicked and got very, just very strange when I think about it. But ultimately, I really took to nursery school and I became something of a in-school truant. This guy, David Hartman, and I would leave class. When I think about it now, I wouldn't do that as a high school kid. Well, I did some of that, but not like this. Not as brazenly, and we would hide in these places, and it was just wild. And I remember the two teachers. We had two teachers. Mrs. O'Toole was one, and we really drove them crazy. It wasn't nice in retrospect. I also remember my dad coming down, and somehow the parents got involved with refurbishing the classroom, and we took home a hobby horse or some sort of device that we were playing on, and we painted it. That was cool. I also remember vividly December of 1972, the astronauts landing on the moon when I was in nursery school. All right, that's a lot of information there. What the hell? Went to middle school for kindergarten, Schubert School for second grade. Do you really want to know all this? Probably not, but I'm kind of interested in rehashing it. Then we moved to Garden City, and then I went to a place called St. Joseph's for 6 months. We moved to Garden City in the middle part of my second grade, and I must say I did not like Catholic school. I wanted to go because we wore uniforms, and I was actually intrigued by wearing a tie. I was second grade. I walked myself to school two blocks away. That was very standard back then, and I had a Snoopy lunchbox, and that was also intriguing because previously I had come home for lunch, and I just felt like a little worker, and that was very cool. But it was a little bit too strict. I remember getting kind of punished for just getting up and sharpening my pencil. And I remember somebody else, I was just thinking about this the other day, a kid passed around a note that had the F word on it. I had some impression of what the F word was. And he got in so much trouble. They almost called the police on him. It really was intense. He was like in a different program. They almost removed him. He was like under strict supervision, and you'd see him occasionally. It was just, he's in a lot of trouble. Maybe there was something else going on that I wasn't privy to. And then I went to third grade. I went to Stewart School in Garden City. I was there from 1977 through 1981. I had several teachers that I quite frankly did not like very much. They were, looking back, I think they were pretty crummy, to be honest. They were not nice, and they were not very effective teachers. Easy for me to say. I was probably a tough one as far as being a pupil. But I did have a great teacher in sixth grade. His name was Mr. Lapper, and he took a real interest in me, and he had patience with me, and I really thrived. I was a very shy kid, but I thrived under Mr. Lapper. And I'm always grateful. I tried to find him online to see whatever happened, but I think he was about 60 back then, so he most likely died. But very grateful for that experience. And then junior high school, I probably just should have said college. I went to Fordham University. Junior high school, Garden City High School, public school. And then I went to Fordham. Maybe someday I'll tell you why I chose Fordham. I applied to a fair number of schools. Fordham was one of them. Got into a fair number of schools, but I'll go into why I chose Fordham. No regrets. Everything turned out fine, but I went to Fordham University in the Bronx. Let's see here. Why did you decide to join the military? What prompted you to become a Marine? A Harrier pilot? Question mark. I was intrigued that I could join the military, go to Officer Candidate School at the age of 19. So my father was a Marine Corps officer, active duty before I was born. Growing up, he stayed in the reserves. So I remember vividly he would go off 1 week in a month to perform his drill service and 2 weeks a year active duty. Generally, those 2 weeks were in the summer, and as a family, we would accompany him. We'd go to Camp Lejeune or Little Creek, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, Little Creek, Virginia. Sometimes we'd go to Quantico, Virginia. And these were really fun times. We just had a great vacation, and we'd go to amusement parks like King's Dominion and Busch Gardens, and we'd visit Colonial Williamsburg and Washington, D.C., and just had a tremendous time bonding with the family, of course, the pool. We were kids. We were just in awe of an ordinary swimming pool at a Holiday Inn motel. It was like paradise. It was like Club Med times 10. It was awesome. And I saw my dad in uniform. And when I found out that I could do something like that, and I think I first heard about Officer Candidate School, I had heard of it. I didn't really know what it meant. Sometime when I was in high school, and I like, wow, I could do that after my freshman year of college. I was very much in kid mode to think that I could be an adult. Also, I remember my dad saying, you know, I asked him, why did you pick the Marines? And he said, so I could be with the best. And that resonated with me very much. And basically the adventure to do something that I saw my dad do, and oh, by the way, you're serving your country. But look, I'll be honest. I was just intrigued by the adventure of it all. And wow, just joining the Marines. What's that going to be like? And it seemed like a test. And I was drawn to the test of it all. I enroll in the program as a freshman in college. You take a basic physical, that kind of thing. And unlike Pete Buttigieg, you know, he took a physical and was rendered an officer after some paperwork. In the Marine Corps, we have no such program where you can just get a commission so easily. You have to go through Officer Candidate School, which is, on average, there are some variations, a 12-week intense program of physical fitness and academics, military training, boot camp. And a lot of people fail out. It was very difficult. High stress, you know, drill sergeants yelling at you and all that kind of thing. I did it over 2 summers after freshman year and after junior year. At some point, I took a test to see if I had any aviation aptitude. I passed the test, and according to the program, I was guaranteed a seat in flight school, assuming everything else went well. Officer Candidate School, the basic school. To me, it seemed so far flung, the idea of actually going to flight school. I mean, I had 3 years left of college and another OCS session. I'm like, there's no way this is happening. It just seemed, 3 years seemed like a million years back then. But everything worked out. I went through all the training one has to be a Marine officer and as a Marine officer. And I went to flight school in the early 90s. And Marine Corps Flight School was very, it was run by the Navy. First stop is Pensacola, Florida. A lot of academics, a lot of training, a lot of physical evaluations and, dunker, like Officer and a Gentleman, you ever see that thing? And preliminary work to see if you, you know, in fact, do have the aptitude to be a pilot, in addition to the academic test that you took 3 years earlier. Courses in aerodynamics, engineering, meteorology, and then you get to the plane, which at the time was a T-34 Buckeye, or no, I'm sorry, T-34 Charlie, turboprop propeller plane. Based on your performance in that aircraft, you are sent to one of three pipelines, and there were three available to me as a Marine. I could have been a helicopter pilot. I could have been a transport prop pilot, C-130s, or a jet pilot. And that's what I wanted, and that's what I got. I was very, very happy to get Jets. It's competitive, I would say. I don't know the percentage. I think it's something like 10 to 15, maybe 20%, but most wind up flying helicopters, and I wanted Jets, and I was thinking about helicopters, and I have, at the time, I was 24 years old, 23. The idea that in my very first jet flight, I would fly higher and faster than I ever would in a helicopter, that drew me to jets. And also, I was actually dating a girl in the flight program. She was in the Navy, and I kind of became competitive with her. She was in the Navy. We were never going to be in the same squadron or anything like that, but that was a semi-serious relationship. She wound up getting props in the Navy, and I got jets, and I was ecstatic when I got them. And then I left Pensacola to go to Meridian, Mississippi, and that was extremely intense. I was not ecstatic to be there. That was one of the most depressing times of my life initially. I didn't know anybody. I was one of the first to select. All my peers were elsewhere, it seemed like at least. Some of them I caught up with, or they caught up with me. And Meridian, Mississippi, I just had no affinity for this place, and it was hot. It was in the middle of the summer, and I was kind of lost. It was just a tough time. But I buckled down, and I made some friends, and had to learn the T2, how to take that to the aircraft carrier. Did all kinds of crazy stuff, formation flying and aerial gunnery, stuff that I had already learned how to fly when I was in college, but this is really advanced. I remember, I may have mentioned this before, but a friend of mine named Chris Hodges, when we selected jets, he's like, yeah, I can't wait to fly. I can't wait to get there. I mean, do you realize we're going to do formation barrel rolls? And I was like, what? We're going to do what? Yeah, we're going to do barrel rolls in formation. Now, a barrel roll is like a loop combined with a turn. It's a pretty complex maneuver. Yes and no, but to do that in formation, it just seemed insane to me. We're going to do that in formation? And formation flying wasn't something that I was immediately good at in the T-34. So anyway, look, I got through it. It was an amazing experience. It was hard. It was rewarding, and the T2 led to the A4, and then I was selected to fly the Harrier jet. Harrier jet, by the way, is a difficult plane to fly. You need you had to score above a certain average to get the Harrier, although a lot of guys did not want to fly the Harrier. It was single engine, had a reputation for crashing a lot, but I flew the Harrier, and I was privileged to do so. What did you learn the most while serving in the military? What did you learn the most while serving in the military? That is a rather general question. I will just say that, what did I learn the most? I don't know. It's a tough one to, I went from one test to the next. You kind of got a sense of it right there. First, you had to get through this program, and then you had to get through that, and then you had to learn how to fly this plane, and then you had to fly that plane, and then you had to fly another plane, and then you had to go to the aircraft carrier. Then you had to, there were all these tests, and it was, you were learning a skill, how to fly, and that was tough. I mean, quite frankly, was it getting along with people? No, I don't think I mastered that in the military. I'll have to get back to you on that. I kind of learned that I love America, actually, and I love its people. I got to work with people from all walks of life, from everywhere, and very few exceptions. I thought they were all great. Even the ones, I look back, I had some rivalries or whatever, but they were just tremendous, tremendous men and women, and it was just a privilege. Let's see here. What advice would you give to someone that's young and wants to join the military? Don't let anybody talk you into it. I guess that's inherent in this question. This is a decision that has to come from inside. You can talk to some people, but don't let anyone talk you into it. My father, as I mentioned, was a Marine officer and served in Vietnam, but he did not talk me into it by any means. This is something that he really, you know, exposed me to it, but this was my call. And what else? Get yourself physically prepared and enjoy it. Don't wish it away. The other thing I wish I had done, and this is for anybody who happens to be, I guess, 22 or younger, start saving your money then, now, instead of waiting till later. I kind of squandered a lot of the money that I made in the military. It was wonderful to get paid, but I didn't really come up with a financial plan until I got out of the military. I kind of regret that. Let's see. How did you transition into becoming a television broadcaster? Were you more interested in reporting stories as a journalist or being an opinion host? How did you transition into becoming a television broadcaster? Well, I was in the military, and there's a really cool thing that happens at the end of a six-month cruise. When you go out, generally it's 6 months at a time. Sometimes it's a year, but I went on six-month cruises, and I went on what they call a Westpac on an LHA, basically an aircraft carrier. And we went to the Persian Gulf. It takes about 30 days to get there. And what happened? Flew a couple of missions over Iraq. We did all kinds of training in Kuwait and in other parts of the world, and pretty intense and interesting and fun, and we had liberty and whatever. Anyway, on the way back, we stopped in Hawaii, and that's when the ship was opened up for something called a Tiger Cruise. And it's kind of amazing. For the last leg of the trip, and I think it's about 5 days from Hawaii to San Diego, that was the very last leg of the six-month cruise, you can invite friends and family on board for the actual voyage from Hawaii to San Diego. So I had my brother come on, Jimmy, and it was right around this time that I had to tell the military whether or not I wanted to augment to the regular Marine Corps. It's kind of an administrative distinction, but it's an important one, and I was eligible to augment. I won't go into everything, what that means. It's just tedious, and it's not significant, but I had to let them know. It would have kept me in the service a little bit longer. I had no real burning ambition to do something specific outside of the Marine Corps. If you turn down augmentation, it really, you're raising your hand and saying, I'm getting out. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do that. Anyway, I started talking to my brother about what am I going to do? And actually, the more we talked, the more I realized I think it was time for me to get out of the Marine Corps. I owed the Marines 4.5 years after, was it 4.5 years? 5.5 years after flight school. When I got winged in December of 1994, I owed the Marine Corps 5 years, 5.5 years after that, which takes my EAS to, I think, March of 2000, which is, in fact, when I got out. Anyway, we start talking about what I should do. And a lot of, you know, I was 29 years old at that point. We thought about business school. We talked about law school. We talked about joining the FBI. I mentioned maybe I could go into journalism. It didn't seem like I kind of dismissed it as soon as I said it. I felt like I was too old and I didn't have the prerequisites. And my brother kind of stopped the conversation and he said, that's the best idea you've had so far. That's interesting. You could do that. I could see you doing that. And I was like, really? And I started to get excited about it. And anyway, making that decision was a big decision. And I get back. I think I briefly considered joining the FBI. I had a meeting with Louis Free, of all people, and Dan Rather and a couple of others. This was in the summer of 98. I'd already told my dad what I was thinking of doing. And he wanted me to talk to some experts, very kind of him and wise. And being that he had some connections, I talked to Dan Rather about journalism, and I talked to Louis Free about the FBI. And I realized that, Louis Free told me, or maybe it was his deputy, Picard, they were about to go be interviewed by MSNBC, and that's the one time I became very like, oh, wait a second, who are you going to talk to? What's it about? And it occurred to me that the FBI was very much like the Marine Corps, you know, very regimented, hierarchical, you know, but just in civilian clothes. And journalism seemed like more of an adventure. I talked to Dan Rather, very generous with his time. Something interesting happened during that, in the aftermath of our meeting. I'll talk about that some other time. But Dan was helpful and very candid, actually, in his advice, which I appreciated. And I talked to several other people. And then here's something, I guess, going back to that question about what would I recommend for somebody who's thinking about going into journalism or anything. You know, you can. There is such a thing as getting too much advice. Although, you know what? Nowadays, everybody's just on their phone and nobody seems to want to talk to anybody. But at one point I was talking to too many people, and the advice, they started to contradict each other. Some said go to graduate school, some said don't. And I just had to start making decisions for myself. And I sent out about 85 resumes in like increments of 10. You know, I started with New York, Chicago, San Francisco, then I mid-level stations, and then finally pretty small towns. Warsaw, Wisconsin, I think they had a TV station. I was finally hired by Binghamton, WIVT, News Channel 34 in Binghamton, New York. Great, great opportunity. They made me the morning anchor, and I reported one story a night for the evening news. And my first job was as an anchor. My co-anchor was a college junior, somebody by the name of Angela Jensen, who every now and then I see is active on Facebook. Let's see here. The weather guy was nice too, Matt Noyes, who I corresponded with, maybe 15 years, but he was a nice guy. Went to Cornell. Let's see here. Were you more interested in reporting stories as a journalist or being an opinion host? An opinion host had no inkling of being an opinion host back then at all. That, I think you, premature, for me at least, I did not know how I felt about a lot of things. I wanted to, I just had no interest. It never even crossed my mind to be an opinion host. Advice for someone young going into the business? I think I asked that. Top three favorite guests you've ever interviewed and why? Well, honestly, the first one that comes to mind is Johnny Brennan and Kamal from the Jerky Boys. Prank phone call duo. That's one of those interviews where I had so many questions that I wanted answered for my own enjoyment. Most interviews are work in that you are trying to command attention. It's like energy management. It's not just a list of questions. It is creating an energy that people will watch. Unlike a podcast, by the way, where it's not that. It's totally different. And this is a little bit foreign to me because it's not really designed for that. And some people treat it that way, but that's not what I'm doing here. This is pure relaxation. So the Jerky Boys, which I know sounds kind of ludicrous, but those guys are brilliant. You can look at their stuff. I interviewed both of them. And then I could easily say Bill Clinton, News Channel 34. When I first started, I got to interview him. You know, interviews really are work. They are. I enjoy talking to people, learning about them. I guess really one of my favorite ones, some of them have been the podcasts, because you have all the time in the world and it really is kind of, it's leisure. It's leisure. When you're interviewing somebody on television, it's not that, at least for me. There is a job to be done. And I don't know if I enjoy it. I will say, okay, there are two that come to mind though. Let's see here. Anne Marie Murphy, a detective I spoke to on the podcast several months ago. It was a very enjoyable interview. And then another one, you can find it on the WABC website. I should put a link to it. I interviewed Tucker Carlson on the radio show for a book. that he had written, the long slide. There was something about that interview. It was a mix. There were one or two things that I really wanted to know for myself, and energy management is a thing, and there are other factors that you have to be consider. You know, Tucker Carlson, big superstar. There's just a lot. There's always other things that are going on that the audience doesn't really know about. So, and by the way, I had an idea for that. I'll tell you about it next time. But Tucker Carlson, actually, I really enjoyed that interview. And Anne-Marie Murphy, who was the most difficult guest to interview? If you can't say their name, just tell us what made the interview hard. It's really not that hard. You just change your energy. You just, you know, you sense it if they're being difficult. Or the easiest type of interview is live, not easiest, but it's actually helpful when it's live because you have witnesses right then and there, and they will react as you will react. They can see somebody being difficult. And if they are difficult, they're being difficult at their own risk. I had a couple of people get kind of nasty with me. Tyrese, the singer / actor, I wasn't fond of him. Can't remember what he did, but he was kind of he was extremely full of himself. And then there was another guy, a famous country singer. You know him. I can't think of his name, but he was intoxicated. I mean, really drunk, and that was a problem. Fortunately, that was taped, and we stopped it before it was over. And so those come to mind. Maybe I should have looked at these ahead of time. Sorry about that. Let's see here. Who was the most kind of hardest part of hardest part? I'd say the most important part is the introduction. The most important part of an interview is an introduction, and especially if it's live. And you have to be, my advice, or you have to be general and specific at the same time. Elements are very helpful. Visual elements, if you're interviewing somebody cold. I could go on and on about that, but it's the hardest part of interviewing somebody is the introduction. Oh yeah, if you handle the introduction well, then you can kind of relax for the rest of it. It puts them at ease as well. And I hope that answers the question. It's a bigger conversation. Biggest mentor in life would be my father, my mother too. I've gotten fantastic advice and guidance from her. My brother. I know that doesn't really count. My family. I'd have to say Roger Ailes of Fox News was a true mentor to me, offering me advice, professional and personal. I'm very grateful to Roger Ailes. How did your father's career in law enforcement impact you growing up? How did it shape your character, your worldview, and your work ethic? One other mentor I should mention, Mark Simone in radio. He is a fantastic, totally brilliant. Talk to him all the time. How did your father's career in law enforcement impact you growing up? How did it shape your character, your worldview, your work ethic, your ethic? Well, it shaped everything I am, quite frankly. I'll say this, what comes to mind, number one, I just knew he was very good at this job. I knew he was a star. I remember meeting the police commissioner. It was Commissioner Robert McGuire. So this had to be, it was under Koch. So this is sometime between 1978 and 1983. And I could just tell the way he treated my father, he knew him. I had seen McGuire on television quite a bit. So I was meeting a celebrity, and he was a very nice man, by the way. And just when he called me by my name, and but everything he, I mean, everything I am is has been shaped by my dad. Everything from everything. He's I'm very blessed that he was my father, is my father. Tremendous role model, funny, hilarious, smartest guy in the world, really, but so funny. And a person like me, he was driven by adventure, and I was driven by adventure. I think we both talked about that at one point. That was kind of a driving force in our life. We know a lot about your father, Commissioner Raymond Kelly, New York City's longest-serving police commissioner, but how important was your mother to your upbringing? How close are you to her? Well, I alluded to that in the earlier question. And interestingly, they both made me, you know, I talked about energy management as far as an interview, and my mother is very good at managing energy, and so is my dad. But my mother I've seen her do it. I saw her do it at a party once. I mean, I was just absorbing them. I knew they were very, very talented, and growing up, just watching them. And that's another thing, I guess. I was shy for most of my life, and I listened a lot more than I talked. And you can learn that way. But my mother's also, they're both adventurous, and they exposed me to a lot of culture and ideas growing up, and very, very grateful to both of them. And they wanted more, you know, than they had growing up, and I was exposed to, you know, we did interesting things as a family, and again, so grateful. What's the most New York thing about you? I don't know. I don't. That's how. What's the most New York thing about you? I remember just thinking that I truly am a New Yorker. I was on the Good Day New York show, and I know so much about New York. Quite frankly, it's plenty of people know more, but. And the helicopter would fly during those bump shots coming back from a commercial, and I used to play this game, and they would focus on something very, very, with the camera, really a tight shot, and I could always figure out what they were looking at, and they'd reveal what it was. One time it was like a piece of maroon iron, and I said, "That's the South Street Seaport," and the guy was genuinely like, "How did you get that?" And they zoom out, and sure it is, South Street Seaport. I don't know. I have something of a... I'm pretty observant, and I like to look at things. And but how I... Something that's really New York about me, it related to a 9/11 anniversary 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I found some pictures of my brother and I at the World Trade Center when we were probably... I might have been 7 and he was 10. And we would go, you know, we went more than probably other families, that's when I realized, gosh, this really is my home. You know, this is maybe at that point, because I had left New York after college, running around the country and the world in the military. So that's something that, you know, I just came home, that I am home, and this is my home. You once told a friend that guests don't really excite you as a centerpiece of a talk show in the way they might excite other hosts. What is your theory and philosophy on hosting and interviewing? Well, I kind of addressed that already, right? It's a show is too important to allow it to be, its quality to be dictated by a stranger. So you can get too wrapped up in who the guests are, and if they're a celebrity, they need to be treated a certain way and all that stuff. However, Zooming guests has made it less personal, and that's fine, quite frankly. They come into the room, and there's a hell of a lot of energy you have to expend in managing them off air. And so it's almost like jump in a whitewater raft. You know, think about whitewater rafting. And hosting a show is like you're going down a river and you have somebody come on the raft for a little while and you stay there and you splash them a little bit and maybe they splash you back and then they get out. That's kind of what a show is. Let's see here. What attracted you to the home on which you have found the most success and fame? Newsmax. Is that true? What attracted you to the home on which you have found the most success and fame? Newsmax. Well, regarding fame, I guess that is true, at least notoriety. I am better known now than I certainly was during my time at Good Day. That was a local show. And when I was at Fox News, I was a correspondent, and you're only going to get so much recognition as a correspondent. I received a fair amount of attention after Iraq. That I think I said I squandered things. I probably squandered that moment. I may not have been ready for that moment, but what attracted you to the home on which you have found the most success and fame? Newsmax. Well, the CEO of Newsmax is a guy by the name of Chris Ruddy. He's a very smart man, and I'm very grateful to him. I met him at a party, was it in 2019? And it was so interesting that I can't go into all the details because I don't have his permission to talk about everything. And there was a matter that was really hot at the time, really of note. And I'll get back to you on that someday. But we did talk about that there was very little coverage in the country that understood Trump. I felt like I understood Trump the way few others did. Because I'd been studying him for a long time, well before he became president. I met him for the first time. Well, I shouldn't say I met him, but I encountered him in person in 1987 when I was a freshman in college. But I really started to take a... Yeah, he was a subject of some fascination, like for many people, but I really took a hard look in 2011 because I was going to imitate him for some skit I was doing on the Good Day show, and I had to capture his essence. Anyway, he agreed with me about very few people understand, very few journalists offering coverage of Trump that understood him, and there was an opportunity there. Instead of deriding him as like this crazy man, you know, what can we learn from him? And at the same time, I was developing a show, and I showed it to him, and he thought that there was promise there. So it just kind of came together very nicely, and it's been a great experience. Have you ever failed at something? If so, what did you learn from that failure? Oh, boy, of course I failed at... what have I failed at? Well, I wasn't the ace of the base when I was trying to fly, when I was learning how to fly. It was... And you could fail a flight. Every flight was graded. So you can get an above average flight. You can get a multiple above average flights. I think, let's see, I can't remember now how it was done, but there was, you know, unsatisfactory, satisfactory, above average, excellent, or something like that. And each letter had a corresponding numeric value. And if you got an unsatisfactory flight, though, that was an F. That was a failed flight. And you would have to do it over. And if you weren't good the next time, I think they gave you two opportunities, you could be out of the program. And I came close, like a lot of people did. A couple of the flights did not go well. But I made it through the program. And something I really failed at. Of course, you could say personally, relationships, and I have made many personal mistakes. I don't know. Was my bout with drinking, is that a failure? I feel like that's ultimately a success because I don't drink anymore. I don't know. Failure. What is something I tried and failed at? I don't want to... I sound obnoxious, like, you know, I've never failed at anything. Because I know I don't feel that way, But it's not like I didn't fail out of college, but I wasn't the best student I could have been. I made it through the Marine Corps. Was I the best Marine? No. But I was a good Marine. I'm proud of my service. Have I ever been fired? Not really. Once it was kind of apparent that it was time to move on. but I did not consider that a failure by any means. So I guess there are plenty of personal failings, and you fail every day. I feel like a failure if I don't get enough done on a Saturday. I feel like a failure if I don't run in the morning. I feel like a failure if I don't read the Bible enough. I have to ease up on myself. And by the way, I heard once that beating up on yourself and feeling guilty is a penance, a punishment that you inflict upon yourself so you feel entitled to do it again. I paid a penalty, so guilt is a big waste of time. Although it's healthy too, I guess. I don't know. All right, so let's see here. Is there another? How long have I been talking? Is this going on too long? Have you always been a Republican? Have you always been a conservative? Well, number one, I am not a Republican. I am not registered in any political party. And I have not always been a conservative. No, I have not. At one point, I considered myself more aligned with the Democrat Party, especially in the early aughts around the Iraq War. I thought the Iraq War was a great big mistake. I knew it beforehand. I knew it during. I knew it in the aftermath of Mission Accomplished. I said as much on Fox News, where I was working at the time. It's one of the reasons why perhaps I was seen as a problematic person by Roger Ailes at times. As much as I respect him and as much as he was my mentor, I know I presented him problems because ideologically I was not on board with a lot of what Fox News was doing back then, especially about the Iraq War, which is a great big tragic waste. So a couple of things came together. It was a gradual process where I am ideologically, and I'm very comfortable where I am, pro-military, America first, anti-cancel culture. I think the Constitution is magnificent. I think our history is basically good. I think people are individuals. I can't stand the emphasis on appearances and race, and I think we're having a great big stupid conversation about race to avoid having an important one. Does that make me conservative? I don't know. I'm just kind of skimming the surface there. Please tell the listeners about your religious journey, how you were raised. Why did you become an atheist? Wait a second. Why did you become an atheist? I'm not an atheist. What brought you back to God? Okay, well, that's true. When I was 13, I wasn't convinced there was a God. That's all. And I thought, what did I think? I thought that, well, the earth is not the center of the universe. There are all these things that atheists like to point out that I guess I pointed to them, and I thought about it a great deal. I mean, it was on my mind a lot. I'm not saying I thought deeply about it, but it's a long story how I got back to faith, but I'm so glad that I did. Well, God had been tapping me on the shoulder. Sometimes he had been slapping me across the face. And I said to people I knew at the time, was that from God? Do you think God was slapping my face? They're like, no, you're being ridiculous. Come on, let's have a good time. I'm like, you're right. That is silly. Let's go back to having a good time. Although I was going back to having a rotten time. Although I thought it was a good time. God is everywhere. He is in charge, although we have free will. Jesus is his son. The way to God is through Jesus. And I hope I can do his will. My journey is just beginning. Did the negative events of 2012 help you rediscover your faith? Have you been changed by those events personally? Did the negative events of 2012 help you rediscover your faith? Initially, no. I felt very, very sorry for myself after that episode. I felt like a victim, and I was constantly asking, why did this happen to me? And it took several years to realize that, quite frankly, it probably happened for me. And I'm talking about the aftermath. I'm talking about the stigma. I'm talking about it's a brutal thing to go through. And I was falsely accused. So ultimately, that was one of the pieces, though, that episode that put me in a position to rediscover my faith, but it wasn't immediate by any means. I discovered drinking after that, quite frankly. And so much has been written about that that's totally false. Some true. And someday I may sit down and tell that story from beginning to end. I don't know. If you're wondering, once I was accused of assault, sexual assault. And New Yorkers at the time understood. I think there's a real sense of fairness, and they understood that it was nonsense. But I had to go through a process that was difficult, and so did my family. Let's see here. What's been the toughest part in your life, and how did you get through it? Hey, let me see what's next. If you could tell one piece of advice to your younger self, what would it be? What's the toughest part in your life, and how did you get through it? Flight school was, quite frankly, the toughest part of my life. That was tough. The aftermath, that thing I told you about, was very tough, but tough in a different way. Showing up to the squadron in 1996, that was also a tough time. You know what's made everything easier, though? Quite frankly, the Bible. It is the ultimate relief from anxiety. It really is. I so encourage you, if you haven't, to check it out, to start reading. If you could tell yourself, if you could tell one piece of advice to your younger self, what would it be? This is kind of a pointless question when you think about it, you know, but there are two things I would say. Start talking to God, start listening. I wish that is something that I had straightened out, had gotten right much earlier, and instead of being convinced that I was in charge or that I could do, that I was all I needed, you know? Why did you become an ardent supporter of President Trump? What excites you most about him? Do you hope he runs again? Will he win if he does? The candor, the authenticity, his opposition to the Iraq War, which is true. The only time he ever stuttered in his life was when he said to Howard Stern, "Yeah, I guess so." That's how he says it. "I guess so." When Stern asked him, "Should we invade Iraq?" That was in the fall of 2002. He was not in public life. It's just a momentary reaction. And but his ability to connect, and his genius, his genius on all levels. It's just it's amazing to behold, and his policies and his positions. Tell us about your love-hate relationship with Twitter. Oh, is he going to run again? Yes, obviously he's running. My concern is that the left will use his candidacy as an excuse to do desperate things to stop him. And I'm concerned about that. but I want him to run. And I think he will win. Let's see here. Twitter, what can I tell you? It's fun. Sometimes I do wonder, okay, is this a good example? Someone said, if there's truth involved, if it's truthful, enjoy it. You can mix it up in the public square. It's something that I should probably reevaluate soon. What is the one thing viewers would be surprised to learn about you? I don't know. I kind of put it all out there. I don't know. That I like architecture? I mean, that doesn't come up very often on air. I mean, what else is there? What else? It's true. I do say a lot, and what's something that they would be? I don't know. I do love my daughter very much and my wife, and that's fun. They don't get to see her very often. That's great. I think I'm doing a pretty good job so far. It's, but look, we're in the long way to go in raising a daughter and another one soon. What dead person would you most like to meet and get advice from? What the hell? I thought that this was going to be a different question when I first saw it. What dead person would you like to interview? And you know what the answer to that is? I'd like to interview, he's dead, Lee Harvey Oswald, because I believe Lee Harvey Oswald shot President Kennedy by himself, and I think I could prove it. And I think I could draw that out of him in an interview, even if he tried to say that he didn't. My wife, Judith, is Australian by birth, incredibly intelligent, brilliant, beautiful, and so smart. She has a degree, two bachelor's degrees. She went to Columbia at night, got a degree in fine arts in Australia, and then came to America, thought about becoming a doctor, went to Columbia to get a biochemistry degree, pre-med, and got into Temple University for medical school, but disenrolled after a day because at that stage in life, she realized she didn't want to really go through with it. It's funny because I went to Columbia University graduate school for one day and disenrolled for similar reasons. We met on a blind date, and it's been wonderful. It really has, and I get a little, let's see here. You became a father for the first time almost 2 years ago. How did that change your life? It clarifies things. It makes you a bit more responsible with your time. And it's your priorities are, you know what your priorities are. It made me more efficient at work. And it, quite frankly, work now used to kind of, my identity was formed so much by work. Now work really is a means to an end, even though I very much enjoy work. And I work very hard, but I think I work smarter than I used to. Anyway, does that answer the question? What is your greatest hope for the United States? That more Americans will embrace the Judeo-Christian values of our country. Constitution is based on them, and that more Americans will become closer to God. This country does not talk very much about that. It's reserved for a few people on Sunday morning, and I'm surprised how few are talking about it. Once you've been saved, once you know that God is everywhere and he wants to have a relationship with you, he wants to help, I'm surprised more people don't talk about it because it really is good news, the best news. So I hope more people will discover that. And by the way, how I discovered it was through a gift from a friend, maybe 9 years ago. I was given a Bible, the Charles Stanley Life Principles Bible. It's a King James Version, but this has footnotes and explainers and essays, and I remember when I got it, I was mildly offended. Like, what the heck made you, when did you become such a church lady? This is, I got life figured out. I know what I'm doing. And I put it on a shelf and was mildly annoyed. Years went by until I opened it. And it's kind of like getting in shape. That's the best thing I can. It was gradual. And then it was an awakening. But I have a ways to go on my faith journey. I certainly don't have all the answers at all. And there are parts of the Bible I have not yet read, honestly. I have to change that, by the way. I've never sat down and read it from cover to cover. Well, look, it's complex on purpose, I'm told. It's designed that way to bring us back. So that's my hope, that more people will come to know God. Thank you. I hope this has been interesting. It's been somewhat therapeutic, actually, to talk through that stuff. Some of the answers I know I gave short shrift, but all right, look, thank you for listening. And thank you to Semper Savage, our sponsor. You know, I am losing this weight. And all right, here's the deal. I took a before picture not too long ago. And the goal in a couple of months is to be like totally shredded. And just for the heck of it, I'm not going crazy. I'm just eating better. And I am consistently working out. Give me 4 or 5 months. And I just want to see if I can do it. I think I can. Intermittent fasting. And when I eat salads, a lot of them. And that's where my friends at Semper Savage come in. Semper Savage salad dressings and marinades. This is making it so, so pleasant because I've never tasted so much flavor. They have Savage Caesar, Savage Cider, Savage Balsamic, to name a few. And I highly recommend that you check them out. They're good people, by the way, okay? They're really awesome, family-owned and also veteran-owned. So check it out. Semper Savage. Semper Savage. SemperSavage.com. Semper and then Savage.com. SemperSavage.com. And check out these beautiful, tasty dressings and marinades that are totally, and this is important for me, keto compatible, keto, paleo, Whole 30, all that stuff. And salad is really the key. It makes you feel full. You put some protein on there, and anything processed is really bad. So I'm really feeling good about my diet right now. And thank you to Semper Savage. By the way, when you go to SemperSavage.com, put in GK10. The promo code is GK10, and you will get 10% off when you check out. Thank you so much for listening, and to be continued, everybody. Take care.